Who was Alexander the Great? What did he do? Why was he so great? Dr. Elizabeth Bainham is a senior lecturer in classics at the University of Newcastle, and she's focused a lot of her research on Alexander the Great and joins us on the program this morning. Thanks for joining us, Elizabeth.
You're welcome.
And thank you for travelling into the studios too at this time of the morning.
Yes, well, I wouldn't make a habit of it, but it's been fun.
Good on you for doing that. Can you tell us firstly, because what I've always wondered was, who decided that Alexander was great?
Well, the Romans first gave him that name. They're the first people to use that term, as far as we know. And it's kind of in a context of it's a little bit sarcastic too. But there's no doubt that they did see him as a great figure because of his conquests. And he got a lot further east than they did. And they always had this sort of like love-hate relationship with him. But, you know, whether Alexander saw himself as great, well, there's a nice story about that. One of his architects supposedly came to see him and offered to carve Mount Athos in northern Greece, you know, this sort of this massive mountain, into the image of Alexander himself, like a sort of ancient, you know, Mount Rushmore in the United States. So that sort of says something about, you know, about his ego, I think. And even though, of course, it never happened, Alexander supposedly rewarded this guy because he liked the way he thought, you know, he thought big.
Tell us a little bit about his childhood.
Yes, well, he grows up in ancient Macedonia in the 4th century BC, in the latter part of the 4th century, so from 356 to 323 BC are his dates. He's the son of a Macedonian king called Philip II, who's, you know, part of a hard-drinking, hard-living culture, you know, high testosterone environment of hunting, warfare, drinking, lots of sex. His father's also a polygamous king, so he's got lots of wives, you know, sort of lots of lovers. So what this means, in effect, that any children who are born in such a relationship, particularly the males, don't know if they're going to become king.
Mm.
So it's a pretty, you know, toxic atmosphere.
But it's a toxic atmosphere, but it's also a very opulent one.
Oh, yes, very much so. I mean, Philip was the, the richest king in Europe, thanks to gold mines that brought him enormous revenues and his conquests. I mean, he was good at spending money too, but
Was his father a person who was a warrior as well, as much as Alexander? Is that where he got it from?
Oh, yes. Well, the Macedonian king was expected to be, a warrior. It's part of the culture, the ethos. But before Philip II, the Macedonian kings hadn't been terribly successful in war. In fact, at the time of Philip's accession, the Macedonians had just lost an enormous battle with, you know, sort of something like 4,000 of their countrymen killed. So Philip comes to the throne amid a great crisis, and he's able to turn the country around. And at the time of his death, he leaves Alexander of, you know, a consolidated kingdom and the finest army in the ancient world at that time.
To be able to have such an army, you need, number one, people to be in the army, and number two, to be travelling and have conquests of such a broad area, you need money. So how did the people see this? Were they supportive of the king? Were they anti the king? How did they see it?
Well, it's hard to know, but I think, everyone likes a winner. And, I mean, Philip was a successful king and he was able to unify his country. And, of course, the conquests that he made brought land, which he was able to distribute to his nobles, slaves and so on. So, you know, increased wealth that way.
Hmm. Adam joins us. Hello, Adam.
Good morning, Trevor.
Yes, Adam.
You know how these characters sometimes meld into the realm of the mythological? Alexander, he had a horse, is that right?
Yes, he has a horse called Bucephalus.
And there was something to do with how he tamed that horse or something? It was quite, apparently, I just recall that it was something to do with almost superhuman capacity. But look, I won't hold you up. It's fascinating listening.
No, it's a wonderful story that you've raised. I mean, it's one of my favourites, because you know, this horse was apparently was worth a lot of money. You know, Philip II was prepared to pay 13 talents for it, which would be probably a couple of million dollars in our money. And it seemed as though the horse was absolutely unmanageable. And in disgust, Philip, you know, sort of says, take it away. And Alexander, who's only a boy of about 12 or 13 at the time, has been watching what's going on, and he sees what's wrong, and that is that the horse is frightened of its own shadow. And, you know, he says, well, look, you're wasting a horse because you can't manage it. And Philip, you know, is a bit affronted by his insolence, and he says, well, can you do better? And Alexander says, of course. And he goes up to the horse and turns it to face the sun and calms him down, and then, you know, sort of thunders off across the plain. And it's a wonderful story, but what it shows is Alexander's insight, because, I mean, he's able to see what the problem is and assess it. And, of course, that's a talent that serves him as a general.
It's really interesting, a point, though, that Adam makes there where the person gets mixed up in mythology. And especially from around that time.
Oh, well, very much so. And, I mean, Alexander is a huge figure in legend. I mean, there's a body of traditions about him that's actually bigger than our historical sources, called the Alexander Romance. And he's something of a culture hero. I mean, for instance, he features in the Holy Quran as a hero called Dhul Qurnayn. He's part of cultural traditions right across Asia, even into, you know, sort of India and as far as Ceylon. And, you know, sort of fantastic stories that are associated with other heroes get grafted onto Alexander. Like, you know, I mean, he goes down into the Nile in a kind of like a diving bell, and he sees a monster that's 250 miles long, you know, that kind of thing.
It's interesting as well, because you talk about the importance of a great warrior as a leader, but he was also tutored by Aristotle, so there was also a need for to be learned.
Yes. Oh, yes, and I think that that intellectual training is very much part of who he was and, you know, sort of his achievements. I mean, for instance, when he goes on his conquests, he just doesn't take military men. I mean, he takes scientists, he takes philosophers, he takes historians. And, you know, these were people who were meant to observe the territory through which the army passed through, collect specimens, that sort of thing. And I think we can add, you know, attribute that curiosity back to Aristotle.
Hello, Dan.
In about 1987, Iron Maiden released an album, and it had a song on it, quite an epic song called Alexander the Great.
Yep.
It went for about 11 minutes. But before the music started and the song started, they had a short narration of something, apparently, Philip said on his dying bed, I believe, to Alexander. I was wondering how true it was, or whether it's actually a fact, or whether they made it up.
Do you know what the quote is, Dan?
I haven't heard the song for years, but I have a go at it. Apparently, Philip said to Alexander, find for yourself a bigger kingdom, for the one I leave is much too small.
Yeah, that's look. One of my students gave me the Iron Maiden song many years ago, and I love it. You know, I think it's great. But you're right. I mean, that's a line from Plutarch's Life of Alexander, and Philip supposedly makes this comment after Alexander's just ridden Bucephalus. So it's not within the context of his deathbed, but it's certainly something that's attributed to Philip. And, of course, it's, you know, one of those wonderful sayings that's made up in 2020 hindsight, but it's still, you know, it's still powerful. And then, of course, you know, you get a band like Iron Maiden that pick this up and make it a, you know, a great start to their song.
In fact, Brian in Perth said, if you want to learn about Alexander the Great, just listen to Iron Maiden's song called Alexander. It covers everything from birth to death.
Yeah, that's right.
A couple of texts. How did Alexander develop the ideas of integrating his army with the local populations he conquered, says Paul?
Oh, gosh, that's a very complex question. We find him integrating peoples, like, I mean, Persians, for instance, I mean, are appointed to positions of command. Alexander also, towards the end of his life, trains a group called the Epigonoi, who are 30,000 Persian youths, and they're trained in the use of Macedonian weapons and techniques. But, I mean, it's meant to be a blended force. And Alexander also, incorporates units of other native fighters. So It is a blended army, but what I'd also have to say, though, is that the Macedonian corps still remained very special to him.
When he goes in and conquers countries, of which he... Let's get an idea, firstly, of how big an area that he was the ruler of, or that they conquered.
Oh, it's massive. I mean, there's... at the time of his death, Philip II, Alexander's father, was master of Greece. And, I mean, it was his father's war that Alexander inherits because Philip was setting off to punish the Persians for having invaded Greece in the 5th century. So it's ostensibly a war of revenge. But, of course, you know, the subtext is, well, look at all that gold, boys. You know, let's go and get it. And, you know, so if Alexander takes over that his father's position... Essentially, the area of his conquests are the Persian Empire. I mean, he takes the coast of Asia Minor, he takes what's now modern Syria, he takes Egypt, then he moves into what's now the Iranian heartland and further on east into Afghanistan, Uzbekistan and India down the Indus Valley.
Even though he goes in and takes these countries, do the countries still live by their own cultures and their own normal lives after they're conquered? Or is there an expectation that they become and that he is their ruler and that they become Greek?
Well, again, that's a complex question. And, you know, sort of Alexander's really not around long enough, you know, sort of to have established what we might call, you know, his vision for the future. I mean, he's only king for 12 years. It's really the people who come after him, the so-called successors who create the Hellenistic kingdoms. And, I mean, they're the ones that where you see the, I suppose, the influence of Greek culture impacting. But, you know, it's a mix, though. It's never a case of, you know, kind of like a complete imposition of Greek culture upon, you know, peoples in the Near East or Central Asia.
So it isn't as if they're taking over the country because they're wanting to be necessarily the ruler. It's just, is it almost like a bravado thing?
Well, partly that. I mean, I think it's hard to know what drives Alexander. I mean, there's this term that crops up in our sources that, you know, some people have made a lot of, saying that Alexander used it to describe what motivates it himself, and that's a term called pothos, meaning, you know, sort of longing, curiosity, desire even. Whether that was, you know, sort of Alexander's own term or merely a term used by the sources is hard to know, but it does explain something, I think, of... you know, what keeps him going forward. I mean, always this desire to see more, to do more. So you could say that curiosity is a large part of his personality.
You're listening to Overnights on your local ABC. My guest this morning, Dr. Elizabeth Bainham, who's senior lecturer in classics at the University of Newcastle. And we're talking this morning about Alexander the Great. I've got a text here saying that I heard he led from the front and he invented some classic battle moves.
Yeah, well, he does lead from the front because, again, an ancient general was expected to do that. I mean, the Spartan kings, for instance, lead on the front on the far right in, you know, sort of their armies. Alexander was predominantly a cavalry officer, but, I mean, he was still in the thick of the battle. And, you know, sort of although he's very well guarded, in that there's quite a complex structure of guards that look after him. He's so fighting mad that, you know, he's wounded severely several times and he nearly gets himself killed in India when, you know, the army's attacking a fortress and they're a little bit reluctant and Alexander, to give them an example, you know, to sort of to hurry them on, grabs a ladder and goes up the wall. And then the men are ashamed and start scrambling up after him. And the ladder breaks and Alexander's left on the wall. And he's got a choice. I mean, either he jumps back to his men and they're holding up their arms saying, you know, come back to us, Alexander. But not Alexander, you know. I mean, he goes over the wall into the fortress where there are sort of like thousands of these hostile natives and cops an arrow in the breastbone that nearly kills him.
How old was he when he became king?
20.
Geez, that's young, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly is. And that's one of the things that, you know, as I get older, comes home to me more and more, just how young this man is. You know, you think of the average 20-year-old now. I mean, you know, sort of would that person be capable of taking on the campaign of conquest that that Alexander does, and the admin burden that goes with it.
If that's the case, did he have many advisors, or did he rule on the, like, just straight in there and took over? Or did he have a lot of people around him to give support?
That's a good question, Trevor. He does. I mean, and when he becomes king, again, he's inheriting, if you like, the structure of the previous regime that that Philip had, including these older advisers, men like Parmenion and Antipater. Antipater had been Philip's regent, for instance, when Philip went on campaign. Parmenion's one of Philip's most trusted generals. And when Alexander becomes king, it's Antipater who gets him formally acclaimed. And he must have done some sort of deal with Parmenion because, you know, sort of one of Philip's other generals, who was hostile to Alexander, a rival, is killed. And I mean, and he's a relative of Parmenion, so Parmenion was throwing in his lot with the new regime. And of course, that means that it starts out with these men as powerful, you know, influences. But as Alexander's reign goes on, you know, Parmenion's influence is gradually undermined, and he's removed altogether in 331.
Were there people that were against him, or was there a strong following of support for him?
There are conspiracies against his life, and probably the most dangerous occurs in 327 BC, when a group of young men who are called royal youths, and they're meant to wait upon the king, you know, clean his boots, clean his horse, but also guard his bedchamber of a night. And I mean, that means, of course, that they've got very close personal access to him. And they form a conspiracy against Alexander. There are about 9 of them. They gradually work themselves into the one shift so that they're all ready to kill him. And instead of going to bed that night, Alexander stays up, you know, partying, boozing till dawn. And the boys are left with this terrible sense of anticlimax, and one of them betrays the other. So, yes, there are conspiracies against Alexander, but they didn't succeed.
Zach joins us. Good morning, Zach.
Oh, how you going, mate?
Yes, Zach.
I just want to know if it's true. I read somewhere some time ago about Alexander. He encouraged homosexuality amongst his men because it was his belief that he thought if they have a sexual loving relationship, they'll fight harder for one another, like fighting for your wife or fighting for your mother or father, like, so they fought harder. Would you know if that's true or not, mate?
Elizabeth?
Well, it's a good question because, you know, sexuality is a very interesting area in the ancient world. I mean, the aspect that you mentioned about fighting for your lover, you know, that occurs before Alexander's time, and in another context, a place called Thebes, where there was a band of elite soldiers, 300, who were made up of 150 pairs of same-sex lovers. And that was exactly the idea that, you know, sort of it was a matter of honour and pride, and that the younger man, you know, sort of would fight to impress his older lover, and that the older lover would, you know, sort of fight to protect the younger one, and so on. But the interesting thing about the sacred band in Thebes was that Thebes was a place where Philip II spent a lot of time as a boy. And it's thought that, you know, Thebes was a leading military power at that time, and Philip picked up a lot of their kind of like military tactics as well. As far as Alexander and sexuality goes, well, you know, he's like anybody of his time. I mean, he's got lots of lovers. There's a tradition that he has an affair with a eunuch from the Persian court, a man called Bagoas, and his closest friend, a man called Hephaestion, who's a Macedonian general, is thought to, you know, possibly have been a lover of Alexander's as well.
A text here saying, what about Parmenion, who architected many of his great wins? Was Alexander just a figurehead who historians remember as a victor?
Yeah, well, you know, that's a good question. I mean, it's I guess, tempting to ascribe a lot of Alexander's early success to the, you know, to the experience and wisdom of Parmenion. I mean, Philip II supposedly said of Parmenion that the Athenians had 10 generals, whereas he had only one, you know, Parmenion. So the man's military talent was well recognised, but I think it'd probably be going too far to, you know, ascribe all of Alexander's success to Parmenion, because, I mean, he's off the scene after, you know, sort of 330 BC, and yet Alexander still goes on to win brilliant victories. So, you know, he was quite capable of winning without Parmenion.
And I guess it's a good leader or a great leader will, especially if he's called Alexander the Great, will listen to the wisdom of other advisers.
He does when it suits him. You know, there's a famous story of the Persian great king Darius, who tries to come to a settlement with Alexander, and he offers him an enormous area of territory. He offers him his daughter's hand in marriage, you know, all that kind of stuff, if Alexander will make peace and, you know, sort of like agree to Darius's plan. And Parmenion says, well, look, you know, I would accept this if I were Alexander. And Alexander turns around and says, so would I if I were Parmenion, meaning that, you know, sort of the vision and ambition, if you like, of the two men are quite different.
Steve, good morning.
How are you?
Good, Steve.
Look, I've been to Iran a few times, and when I was there the first time on the Caspian Sea, going along the plane, and I saw this 100-metre-high sort of little hill in this flat country, and I said to my Iranian friend, what's that doing there? And he said, have a look, and he can see a whole row of hills going through, and he says, that's what Alexander built to communicate. And there's every 3 or 4 kilometres, and the people would signal from one hill to the other. And that's how he communicated all the way back to Macedonia from where he was.
That story, Elizabeth?
Look, that's one that I hadn't... I mean, I know the idea of the Persians sending these relay messages from hills, where they, you know, they've got these guys who get up on a hill and they, you know, sort of shout the message across and... you know, sort of some sort of system of codes or what have you. But it's interesting that it's ascribed to Alexander because, I mean, it was a Persian practice, you know, sort of before Alexander comes along. But, of course, he conquers the Persian Empire. So, you know, I guess it's only natural that it gets ascribed to him. And you find that all sorts of things are picked up and grafted onto Alexander then. I mean, for instance, I know I can remember another gentleman some years ago who'd spent a lot of time in India, and he was telling me that, you know, sort of Alexander's like a kind of like a boogeyman to, or he's used as a boogeyman to Indian children. I mean, the mothers will say if the children are naughty, look, Sikandar Shah, Alexander the King, will come and get you unless you behave. So, yeah, it's interesting how these things get passed on. But the story of kind of like Persian messengers, yes, I had heard that, but not ascribed to Alexander, so that's nice.
Good morning, Roger.
Good morning. I read once that Alexander's father was assassinated. This is Philip. Is it true that he's possibly Alexander's mother was involved, who could have thought that her own position in the court could have been threatened with respect to Philip's other wives? Is there any truth in that story? Or
that is a can of worms. I mean, the ancients certainly thought that Olympias, that's Alexander's mother, had a hand in, you know, sort of his father's murder. And it's the old story, isn't it, that with any murder story about who gains from the murder, and of course, Alexander and Olympias did gain the most. So, you know, they were the prime suspects, so to speak. And there are other traditions about Olympias kind of honouring the body of Philip's assassin, that kind of thing. But look, personally, I don't think Alexander was involved in his father's murder. He's not out of favour at the time that Philip is killed. I mean, in fact, if anything, Philip is showing honour to Alexander at the occasion of Philip's daughter's wedding. I mean, he enters the theatre with Alexander on, you know, sort of one side, as though to say, well, look, this is my my heir. And even though, you know, you're right about Philip having other wives, and he had recently married a bride who was considered, you know, sort of to, if you like, be a good breeding potential for more male heirs. As far as we know, she hadn't actually given birth to a boy at that time. And even if she had, that child's got to grow up, you know, sort of, whereas Alexander's already 20 and on hand. So although you're quite right to raise the question of, well, you know, is Alexander's position threatened at all at the court? Well, yes, I mean, you can point to aspects of it, but, yeah, it's also, I think, not a terribly compelling case either.
Go back to some more calls. Good morning, Barry.
Yeah, good morning.
Yes, Barry.
Look, a few years ago I saw a movie called The Man Who Would Be King, based on rugged Kipling novel starring Sean Connery and Michael Caine, where they're in Afghanistan or that sort of their part of the world, and they're about to this group or this tribe is about to kill Sean Connery, and they discover that he's got around his neck, he has a Masonic symbol, a necklace with a Masonic symbol on it. And they suddenly think, well, he must be a god, because years and years, centuries before, this person called Alexander came through and he had the same symbol, so they treated him as godlike and a ruler for a while. And I've always wondered about the truth or otherwise of that particular story.
Yeah, look, I love The Man Who Would Be King. I mean, I think it's a great film. You know, I mean, in terms of capturing, if you like, that spirit of adventure too, that's, I think, comes out very strongly with, you know, sort of when you look at the story of Alexander's campaigns. I mean, you know, you also have to take into account the human cost as well. But, you know, sort of I think most people respond to the aspect of adventure. As far as the Masonic sign goes, no. Like, I'm not sure where that came from, you know. I mean, it's the Macedonians certainly do have a very striking symbol of them their own. I mean, it's this great sunburst, big 16-pointed star that they carried around with them. But, you know, I don't know of any association of the striking Masonic symbol. But, you know, and I have to say, too, I don't know a lot about the kind of Masonic iconography, but a lot of these things are based on, you know, sort of Indo-European signs. I mean, even the Nazi, you know, the infamous Nazi swastika, for instance, goes back thousands of years.
At this time, did people see Alexander as a god, or did he see himself that way?
Look, you know, I think he did. I know it's a hard concept for us because of, you know, sort of our religion. It doesn't matter whether, you know, you're Christian or Muslim or Jewish. I mean, we're so conditioned to the idea of one God that a human being seeing themselves as a God, you know, was just crazy, you know. But in the case of Alexander, I mean, he grows up in a world which is... It's polytheistic. I mean, there are lots and lots of gods, not only the 12 Olympians, but, you know, other minor deities, river gods, woodland spirits, all that sort of thing. Mm. And I think the most important aspect of that is that the most the beloved hero of Greek mythology is Heracles, or Hercules, as most people know him. And he's born a man but becomes a god because of his great deeds. And, you know, sort of when Alexander's deeds have surpassed those of any other human being, people are going to start thinking, well, gosh, you know, this guy must be divine. And time and time again, he's in situations where, you know, you would expect that he'd get killed, and he doesn't. People surrender to him because, I mean, they think he's divine and so on. So if you like, I think in the end he probably ends up believing, you know, his own legend, if you like.
John, good morning.
Morning.
Yes, so, John.
An interesting story about Alexander the Great. Years before he crossed over into Asia to begin his conquests, he had a dream. And the dream was about a city that he conquered, and the religious leaders came out to meet him and welcome him. And he thought this was a most amazing dream. Now, years later, when Alexander was conquering Tyre, he didn't have enough men, and he sent up to Jerusalem for the Jews to send down troops and help us so as they could help him to conquer and take Tyre. And they wouldn't do that because the people of Tyre had helped and sent material for the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem. And so Alexander, he was pretty put out about this, and he vowed that he would take and conquer Jerusalem eventually. So when he was free from the his involvement at Tyre, he marched up in his army up to Jerusalem, and he was going to teach the Jews a lesson. And actually what happened, the Jewish high priest had a dream, and he was told by God to go out and welcome Alexander. So when Alexander surrounded Jerusalem to besiege it, they opened the gates, and the Jewish priest, the high priest, and the people with all their regalia and robes on marched out to meet and greet Alexander.
So his dream came true?
The dream came true.
Elizabeth?
Yeah, look, that's a marvellous story, and it's a very interesting tradition. Not many people know it, so it's great that you raised that. And I heard a superb lecture on it some years ago by a scholar from the United States called Professor Getzel Cohen, I mean, from Cincinnati, and he was very interested in that tradition, I mean, its origins, its truth and so on. I mean, it's, you know, sort of probably not historical as such, but it's interesting how the story has come about. And again, I think it says something about the way that a lot of people want to be connected, you know, sort of with Alexander in some way. I mean, for instance, in ancient Egypt, you know, you find a story that Alexander, in fact, was not the son of Philip II, but rather the last surviving Egyptian pharaoh, a man called Necténebo. And likewise in the Persian version of the Alexander romance, you know, sort of Alexander's a relative of the Persian great king, you know. So I guess what I'm saying is that you find different cultures, different peoples building Alexander into their own mythology, into their own stories, in a way which, of course, makes them look good too.
Brett, good morning. You there, Brett? Lost Brett. We'll go to Simon. Good morning, Simon.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Good, Simon.
Okay, I'm just wondering if you knew that was mentioned in the Bible in Daniel chapter. Well, it starts off in Daniel chapter 2, but it goes clearer in Daniel chapter 7. And he's talked about as a male ghost that comes across wicked hits the male lamb, which is Furious.
Simon, your line is really bad, Simon, but I guess what Simon's asking is about Alexander being mentioned in the Bible.
Yes, a little bit vague on that. I know he certainly appears in the Quran.
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of the Persian kings appear in the in the Bible, in the Book of Esther and so on. I don't know of a tradition that specifically mentions Alexander.
Okay. Can I just ask you, as a historian, how do you work, because storytelling is history, how do you work between the myth and what is historical fact?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, because particularly when you're dealing with sources that are thousands of years old, I mean, there's always this temptation to think, well, you know, they make it all up. And I mean, even ancient historians accused other historians of previous generations or even in their own time of, you know, sort of essentially storytelling. So it's an old issue. But in the case of Alexander, I mean, we've got quite a rich tradition of ancient sources, but none of it's contemporary. I mean, we don't have any accounts of people who went with Alexander or anything that Alexander wrote himself. I mean, so it's not like, say, Napoleon, where, you know, you've got letters and diaries and that kind of thing. With our ancient sources on Alexander, though, they start in the period of the Roman Empire, so about the 1st century BC, and then go through to about the 2nd century AD, so about the time of Hadrian. But they used the histories of people who had gone on the expedition, so they're using eyewitness accounts.
Very quickly, Rex,
it is.
Yeah, very quick.
In Turkey, they've got a statue of, or a plaque of the battlefield with Alexander and the Medes and Persians.
Thank you very much. Just before we go, Elizabeth, we're about a minute and a half away from the news. What do people like Alexander do in their spare time when they're not out conquering?
Well, he liked to drink, you know. and again, that was a sort of like a Macedonian thing to get on the grog with your mates. I mean, your hetairoi. He liked a conversation. I mean, according to one of Alexander's sources, a man called Aristobulus, I mean, he wouldn't drink. I mean, he really liked the talk, so he would just sort of sit on the one glass all night. But I mean, it's hard to believe that when Alexander also burned the Persian palace of Persepolis down, I mean, as a result of a party, at least in one story. And we're also told that after a party, I mean, he often slept not only, you know, sort of the day after the party, but the following day as well. Well, you know, that doesn't really sound like someone who's kind of only had the one, the one glass. So drinking, hunting, games, that kind of thing.
Kingly things. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much, Elizabeth.
It's been wonderful, Trevor, and thank you to you and your listeners.